Moncrief on News Talk.
With the all-new Dacia Duster. We've even impressed ourselves with this one.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. It is indeed time for parenting. Joanna Fortune joins us once again. Good afternoon, Joanna.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Are you well?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm really adjusting to this new kind of hibernation lifestyle, I have to say.
Yeah, it's funny that some people actually seem to really like it and maybe are a little surprised to discover they like it, and other people are clawing the walls kind of thing.
I think, you know, I'm just wired anyway to try and positively reframe what's going on, I think. But I also think it's this way of just going, it's an opportunity to get other stuff done, but just do it at a less frenetic pace. I think it just highlights how quick we all move and how busyness has become like a feeling state. You know, when you say to someone, how are you feeling? The default answer is busy. And now they don't really get to say that.
Yeah.
I think there is an opportunity for us. Yeah.
I always hated that "are you busy" question anyway, as if that was necessarily a good thing. Anyway, let's move on to our first.
Yeah.
Our first question of the day. My daughter is 4 and will be 5 in May. She still gets tired when we're out and about and will complain to the point that either I or her dad carry her. But she's heavy to be carrying long distances, so we kept using our buggy. When we go anywhere, she always reminds me to pack it quite like I do. At what age should kids stop using a pushchair and just stick it out and walk?
See, this is such an interesting one because there isn't really a should on it. Okay, so first of all, I'd always start with if any child has a developmental or mobility additional need, then of course you would use your buggy for a longer period of time to meet their needs. I can understand why parents with a slightly older child, if you're in, you know, like a really busy public place or on public transport and just a need to manage them that they don't get away from you, a buggy can be handy. Or if you've a child who is, look at all children that age have high impulsivity, but if they're extremely impulsive and they don't do any impulse control, even, you know, when you warn them, hold my hand, let's cross the road this way, then I can see it. But I also think that, you know, and this is where the question, I guess, is coming from, is children develop strength and, you know, in terms of muscle, strength and conditioning by walking increasing distances for themselves. And they have a need to be physically active, at least 60 minutes of fast-paced movement a day. And it's also a way of them, when they begin to do it themselves, walk for themselves, it's a good opportunity to start building independence. So for all of those reasons, if there isn't a physical, developmental or mobility reason for your daughter who's almost 5 to be still in her buggy, then it's really coming down to a parental choice because she doesn't need to be in it. She might want to. It might be quite nice to, you know, be pushed around, have a book in her hand, just watch the world go by. That might be quite nice, but it's definitely not a need. In fact, her developmental need is that she will benefit from walking around herself. So what you could do, and I hear very clearly, you know, for the quiet life, just bring the buggy. I do hear that. But what you could do is forget it just on one occasion. Just forget, okay. Oh, I forgot to bring it. You're just going to have to walk. And so they, you know, your child might be upset. Oh, I want the buggy, and go, yeah, I really wish I'd brought it too, but I forgot it. What are we going to do? We're just going to have to walk. And build it up with her. Don't take her out now for some epic, you know, 3-hour hike as your first day. You're going to forget the buggy. But build her up in it, you know, gradually. And I think, you know, even if you do have the buggy with you, the first time she's like, I'm tired, I want to get into the buggy, say, oh no, you need to walk for another 10 minutes before you can get in the buggy. And just try to push it out bit by bit. So it's not a should thing, but developmentally, it's definitely in her interest at this age, if she can walk, to be walking.
Are you implying their 4-year-old is just lazy?
I would never say that, Sean.
No, of course not. I was diagnosed with cancer at Christmas, says this person. It's a long road and I'm not there yet. I have 2 daughters, 14 and 17. I found that my 14-year-old has started resenting me slightly because I don't have the energy to do things with her. Before this lockdown, I missed a lot of her activities, and now that we're all at home, I spend my time in bed or in the hospital. My oldest has been doing a lot of the chores with my husband, like the cooking and cleaning. It's really upsetting for everyone, as we just want normality, as neither of them can have that. How do I talk to them about it? I haven't had a big chat, as I'm very matter of fact, and explained to them what was happening. I don't like to complain to them, so I tend to take to the bed mostly. They are my babies, and I don't want their teenage years being so affected by me being ill. How can I make it easier on them?
Oh, it's just so difficult, isn't it? You know, it's so difficult to be living with an illness like that. And, you know, obviously you're worried about everybody else. But, of course, there's additional worry for this person and for her family about her, you know, with COVID-19 and her being more vulnerable. So, I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying your 14-year-old resents you. But I suppose I'm going to question that a bit, because it sounds more like fear than resentment.
Yeah.
And if it is resentment, I'd wager it's cancer that she resents, not her mum. And I think that the best thing you can do now in terms of how can I make it easier on them, bring them in. You know, bring them in, let them sit on the bed beside you, give them something to do for you, something practical. Ask them, you know, especially your 14-year-old, if your 17-year-old has already found a kind of functional way of being busy and contributing through chores and cooking, give your 14-year-old something tangible. Maybe she could do your nails for you while you rest in bed. She could bake you something you really like. She could read to you. You were saying you missed a lot of her activities, you know, even before this kind of social distancing and restricted movement piece. But if you did, is there any chance that she could sit and talk you through what's been going on in her activities? Just literally sit and say, look, I haven't been going to those, but fill me in. How's it going? What's the developments? Have you any photos? Did you get any video of you doing whatever the activity is? I'd love to sit and watch that with you. I think bring them in, because the matter of fact, you know, when you say you've been matter of fact and you've explained to them what's happening, that's all about logic and reasoning and really appealing to that left brain. Okay, look, I have this illness. It's called cancer. This is how the treatment is. This is how long it will take. Here's how I'm feeling. And that's important, by the way, that you do share that information. But now it's time for the over and above stuff, the more emotional stuff. How is it feeling for everybody to be living with cancer? And that's what's happening here. You're all living with cancer. Cancer has moved in. So you can't ignore it. You can't squeeze around it. You actually have to find a way of speaking about it and saying, look, this is part of our family story now. So it changes things, because before cancer, I was able to do all this stuff with you, and now I'm just not. It doesn't mean I don't want to. It just means I'm not. So we need to find a new way of spending time together.
Yeah. Is there a bit of guilt here as well, in the sense that sense that mom doesn't want her disease to affect, you know, the teenage years of her daughters?
Oh, yeah. And I totally get that. But the reality is cancer is there. You know, it's there now. And, you know, something affecting your children's teenage years doesn't mean it ruins their years. It doesn't mean it steals their adolescence. An effect can be positively used to strengthen and enhance a relationship as well around it. You're simply going to find a new way. So in the way you lessen the negative impact on their years is by finding an alternative way to positively connect in and around this. But don't just treat it like this matter of fact thing. It's not. It's highly emotional. You're their mom and they're scared. And you're scared. Mm. It's a scary thing. That's a really sensible emotional response to have. But I think at 14 years old, it's, you know, the difference development. It's only a couple of years, but between being 14 and 17 is huge. At 17, you're capable of much more adult thinking and decision making. At 14, you're in the throes of adolescent impulsive development. So it's very, very different for the two of your girls. So I think you've got to treat them differently. And don't think just because your 17-year-old is busy doing, make sure that she has that time to connect as well.
Yeah. And I suppose the reality is they are going to be taking on a little bit more and, you know, the mom has to accept the reality of that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, especially if you've been, you know, a matriarch in a house and now you're handing over that kind of control and that functioning to somebody else. But trust in the job you've done. You've got two young women in your house and, you know, you've parented them this far really actively and hands on. Trust what you've done. Trust that that's going to carry you all forward and that they can now give back to you and let them. Because it may be really important that you actually take a step back and let them do the caring for you for a while. And then you'll all get back on track. But at the core of this is finding a new way to connect and relate so that you protect the relationship. And that is entirely possible, but it's about bringing them in emotionally.
My 7-year-old son has very recently started to pull and tear at his nails. He's not biting his nails. It's like he's ripping layers off them. He tears the nail and then tears the skin around the nail. It looks so painful. And to be honest, it looks disgusting. I've tried to ask him to stop and even have been putting plasters on his fingers. But by the end of the day, the plasters disappear fairly quickly. I don't know why he's doing it or what triggered it, but we needed to stop.
Yeah, I mean, no. Well, you really want it to stop, but the only way that it's going to stop is by understanding why he's doing it and what triggered it. So in one way, if you keep just responding to the symptom, don't bite, don't bite, don't bite, you're not getting to the piece of why are you biting. So I think you've got to pause and take a few steps back. And just if it's happening very recently, and I'm not quite sure exactly what that means, but if it's in very recent weeks, there is certainly plenty of cause for young children to be anxious and dysregulated and worried and distressed at the moment with the huge changes to their lives. You know, he's not in school anymore. He doesn't have access to his friends. He won't be attending extracurricular activities. Whatever way you were doing childcare and working in home or out of home, all of that has changed as well. So there's been huge upheaval in his life. And might that be what has unsettled him? And, you know, so the first thing for me is asking, is he worried? And also, is he even, consciously now, is he aware he's doing it in the moment? Mm. Or is it when you say stop doing it that he's like, oh, right, and he's suddenly aware? Because if you get pulled into a power battle with something like this, the behavior will only intensify. The best thing you could do is distract him and give him a task to do in the moment you see it happening that occupies his hands, you know, that requires him to use his hands. Because when we think about things like nail biting, and this sounds like, you know, nail ripping, that he's literally taking off little layers of the nail bed, right down to the nail bed, it's actually a very common nervous habit. You know, it's probably one of the most common nervous habits that we see. But it also can be something that children or people do when they're bored, understimulated, daydreaming, zoning out, if they're just curious or if they're intensely thinking about one thing. It's almost like this is something that, a bit like a fidget spinner, it's like a fidget urge that they can do. We do see, though, that it's in this way that, you know, it's at an extreme level, that it's most common in more highly strung children who are more susceptible to high emotional responses to situations. And again, that brings me back to, could it be what's going on here and what's happening around him? So I think sit down and talk to him. Sit down and wonder about how he's coping, what's going on, what's changed. Talk certainly about, in practical terms, you know, about hygiene and that his nail beds mightn't be that clean, and we're being really mindful about clean hands and taking care of our hands. And I'm imagining if he has bitten his fingers and nails down that much, excessive hand washing and using hand sanitizer might actually be quite painful if his skin is very raw. So talk about repairing his nails and repairing his hands, and that you're going to rub on some really nice, whatever it is, E45 cream, and you're going to really rub it in and hope that his fingers can drink up that lotion. Give him lots of nurture and sensory play with this, because I think there has to be some kind of a tactile, messy, touch-based exploration that will actually fulfill the need that the nail biting is currently filling. And rather than plasters, because plasters aren't brilliant for this, they can be easily taken off or they fall off, or just putting plasters on his fingers isn't really nice for him. If you have access to a pair of cotton gloves, they tend to come in lots of those mini at-home manicure sets. That could be something. But you say to him, rather than I'm putting these on to stop you biting your nails, you put loads of lotion on and you say, I'm putting these on for a while so that your hands can drink up the lotion and we can take care of your hands. So again, it's that positive reframing about, I'm not doing it to stop you, I'm doing it to help and heal you. And it sounds like that's a semantic thing, but actually that sends a very different message to him. And again, you're avoiding that power battle of, I will make you stop, because actually maybe that's not within your range to do so. If it is about anxiety or worry, though, and you know, he's like, well, I'm really worried about this and I really want to get back to whatever his hobbies and activities in school is, rather than, because you can't give him guarantees about that either at the moment, maybe there's an alternative, something like a worry stone or a piece of soft material that he could put in his pocket. And when he feels like he wants to bite, that he could rub that instead and see, can that be enough to keep him in the now moment, out of his head, out of that spiraling thought, and just regulate him using a sensory tool like a worry stone or a soft piece of material. I think that could help. But it's the very recent here that just has me interested in, could it be a response to the current environmental change?
Yeah, it could well indeed. Right, we do have to take a break after that. A six-year-old who likes to talk a lot. 53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cents. Joanna Fortune is still with us. Just referring back to some of the questions that we've Joanna's been dealing with already. One was about an almost five-year-old who still likes to use the buggy when she's out and about with the parents. One texter says, I used the buggy on my son until he started school. Once he saw other kids in the school didn't use theirs, he refused to use it as he wanted to be a big boy. That's a good motivation. Someone else says, take the wheel off and show them it's broken so they have to walk. With my lot, having the evidence makes them understand more than just saying no. That's an interesting
idea. That's certainly a way to go. Yeah.
Yes. We did get a question in from a mother who has cancer, and it's a struggle for her, obviously, but it's a struggle for her teenage daughters too. That mother is amazing with all she has going on and that she's going through. She's more concerned about her daughters and how it's affecting them rather than herself. Just get better and you'll be the best mother ever. And they'll remember how strong you were. Not that they did some cleaning for a week back when they were teenagers. Well, indeed. But obviously she's already the best mother ever. And we also had a question in about, I think it's a five-year-old. He's kind of ripping at his own nails. One texter says, as a child in early primary school, I started pulling skin from the side of my thumbnail. No idea why I started. I think the kid beside me showed me how. I'm 43 now and totally regret ever starting it. Now I have to do it as the outer layers of skin grow back hard and painful. I have to use things like scalpels and files to pare it down. Crikey. And someone else says, I had a nail biting issue with my son. Introduced chewing gum, which I despise, but it worked. So,
yeah, something like that, like even a chewy toy or just something to fidget with, can actually be a really good solution to that.
Yeah. Now, next question is this. My six-year-old talks a lot, and I mean a lot. Not just a question here or there. 90% of his awake time he spends talking, even while he eats. It irritates people, his teachers, and even me sometimes. There is no such thing as quiet time with him. Every movie and show is ruined. His brothers can't cope with him. Should I be concerned that he genuinely does not stop and take a breath? It's incessant.
Oh, God. I mean, I know there's so many reasons about this, but I do get it's not just about the amount of time he's talking when I read this or how much his talking is taking up or now else. It's when he's talking, where he's talking, and what he's saying. So when we look at kids who have this tendency, and let's be honest, it's not just kids, but it's often around that they talk at inappropriate times, such as during a movie or show or in school when the teacher's trying to teach. They talk over others, which makes, others give them a hard time. They get a lot of negative feedback because they're constantly intruding on conversation. Or we might also see that they end up, not even intentionally, but offending others by speaking without pause, which means they're not filtering what they're as soon as I think it's out my mouth, I'm not filtering. Might this be upsetting for you? Might I say this in a different way? And when we look at why kids do this, it can be that they get fixated or super passionate about a topic, any parent who has a child who collects Pokemon cards or, football cards, and they are a master at this topic. They could talk and talk for days on it. It can also be, though, that children get stressed about something and it's a pressure of speech. It's that kind of, it's just like word salad. It's just gushing out of them just to fill the silence. If I stop, I'm going to have to think and feel. So I won't think and feel. I'll just talk instead. And they talk all the time to avoid the feeling that's going on. And it can also be a sign that they're having some difficulty with social cues, reading those cues in others, how you might be experiencing me, changing what I'm doing and how I'm doing it to elicit a different response, and struggling with self-control. Now, he's still only six, okay? So my expectations around really understanding social cues in others and having a high degree of self-control are that, you know, children can really struggle with that, certainly until 7 years old. And again, I mean, developmentally more than chronologically. So I don't know with this little boy, you know, does that explain why he might be doing it? But now that he is doing it, what can you do about it? I'm going to suggest that you play your way out of it a bit. Role play having a conversation with him. You know, you could make this, you know, fun and put a few topics, very general things that you know he's able to talk about, and a couple of things that he might be challenged on that he might not know as much about. Put them into a little box or a jar, pick one out and say, for 3 minutes, we are going to talk together. We're going to have a conversation about this. And there has to be that serve and return over and back. And use something like make yourself a talking stick if that's helpful in just getting him going. But I prefer it to be a conversation that you can then reflect on afterwards. And that you could say to him, you know, in that 3 minutes, you talked for two of those minutes. That meant I only got 1 minute to talk. I wonder how that might make me feel. What do you think? And have him reflect that way. Mm. You could have a little pause situation with him that you talk to him very directly and say, every few sentences, I want you to pause and count to five and just look around how everyone else is reacting to you. I want you then to maybe develop a signal, a nonverbal signal that you can give him, you're doing it again. So this is only going to work if you say to him, look, this is a problem and something we have to work on for when you go back to school, because the teacher says, you know, it's a bit of a trouble in the class if you keep talking all the time when everyone's trying to do their work. So here's a signal and we're going to practice doing it a different way so that he knows, oh, you're signaling me to stop. Other than that, you need a lot of patience and empathy about what is this about for him. And another little game that just comes to my mind now is looking at silent communication play, so that you tell him that you're going to play a game where nobody can talk and you have to just use your facial expressions to put across how you're feeling and what you might be thinking. And you have to try and work out in response to each other non-verbally what's going on, and do a little bit of play like that with him. Or get two empty tin cans, you know, bean cans or something like that. Wash them out. Make sure there's no rough edges around the top. Push a little hole with a knife or a screwdriver through the end and put some string or, you know, twine through it. Tie a knot and make old school telephones. You know, the way, no, well, maybe lots of people didn't do this, but, you know, like when you were a kid, you could make phones this way. And stand far apart, pulling the twine taut between you, and show him how an old phone worked, that you would talk in, he has to put it to his ear and just listen while you're talking. Then it's his turn to say something back while you listen, your turn to say something back while he listens, and you get this over and back. I think the best thing with a six-year-old to affect, you know, meaningful change in this kind of behavior is to approach it in a doing, not saying way. Use creative play methods with him.
Yeah. Okay. Could it be a competitive thing? There is a mention there of brothers and just trying to get a word in edgeways.
Yeah, it seems like he's winning, though, to be fair to him. So like, it might be about, okay, you've got this competitive edge. Now it's other people's turn as well. But you're right. If it's a busy, loud, boisterous house, you can have one extreme or the other. You can have a child who says little to nothing, and you could have the child who goes, I will make sure that my thoughts are heard on this. I will get in there first and I will get in there loudest.
Yeah.
It just sounds like it's a constant thing, and it's not just at home. It's also spilling out into school.
Okay, one last quick question. Very opposite at the moment. How do you encourage a two-year-old to learn to play on his own? He's an only child, but always insists either me or his dad get involved. What age is it appropriate to play on your own? I would love to get his imagination going, but I feel we're not enough for him.
Okay, so look, I mean, the imaginative play, children are imaginative at two, but it's really around, you know, 3.5, 4, that projective, narrative, you know, magical, omnipotent, imaginative thinking really ups a notch. And playing alone is actually a developmental task in and of itself. And between 18 and 24 months old, the maximum you'd really get out of any child who is, you know, happy and willing to play alone is 20 to 30 minutes. So one of the things you could do is set a task like block building, a basic jigsaw, colouring, whatever it might be, something like that. You're going to sit in the room reading your book or observing while he plays, but he's going to do the play. Or you could leave the room and return after 15, 20 minutes to play with him. But obviously, I wouldn't leave a two-year-old completely unsupervised for that long. So you want to be audibly close and throw an eye every kind of 7 or 10 minutes. Come in, play with him again, and then leave him for another burst of time. But at his age, you know, given he's still only the bare 24 months, I would be saying start with 5 to 10 minutes of solo play and gradually increase it. But hold in mind at this age that you are his favorite toy, his parents. You are the favorite toy that he has. All of his learning is happening in relation to you. Toddlers are very intersubjective. They get their whole sense of self, others, and the world through their important caregivers. So you want to ensure that you are truly playing with him for that minimum of 15 minutes a day. And I mean, no phones, no distractions. You're 100% in his play. And look at ways to integrate his play into your other tasks that you have to do. You know, give him, as you're peeling vegetables, fill the bowl with the veggie peelings and let him, you know, mush them with his hands, make faces out of them with him. Just play with them. Or, you know, while you're cooking, sprinkle some dry rice onto the floor or into two little cups that he can pour one to the other, or he can spill on the floor and in his bare feet walk and dance on it. So he is playing around you while you're getting something done. That's another way to do this. But, you know, embrace the fact that you are the most important thing to him. It won't last forever.
Yeah, indeed. It's probably a bit difficult at the moment.
It's a little intense, literally a full-time job. Yeah.
Joanna, thanks a million for talking to us today. Stay well. Talk to you next week. That's Joanna Fortune there. We're going to take a break. After that, the story of coffee.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With the all-new Dacia Duster. We've even impressed ourselves with this one.